I don't want anybody out there to get what I treat. And the best way to do that is to prevent it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
What I treat is actually a temporizing measure. I'm just bypassing a blockage or opening up a blockage, but the disease process that caused it to get there isn't going away just because I open up an artery.
This is the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast, and I'm your host, Maya Acosta. If you're willing to go with me, together we can discover how simple lifestyle choices can help improve our quality of life and increase our longevity in a good way. Let's get started. All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast. I'm your host, Maya Acosta, and this is
Dr. Riz.
And today we have another episode of Doctor in the house, where Dr. Riz joins me on a Monday to answer some questions. And today, Dr. Riz, we're going to learn more about what you do as a vascular surgeon. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay.
I hope I answer these questions correctly.
What is the most common procedure that you do?
Yeah, I mean, the vascular surgery does comprise a variety of different types of procedures all over the body. But I particularly focus on lower extremity revascularization. Lower extremity means the legs, and revascularization means improving the blood flow. And so about 70 to 75% of what I do has to do with fixing the arteries and restoring the blood flow to the legs. There's a spectrum of diseases that affect the legs that require that. The early on symptoms are just when people are having some pain mm-hmm. when they're walking, mm-hmm. and that's called claudication. And that's because as they walk, the blockages restrict the blood flow enough that they're not delivering enough blood flow to supply the muscles. We can go in and open up the blood vessels and improve the blood flow. The far end of that spectrum is that that somebody has some sort of wound on their foot or gangrene, and something as simple as a small opening to challenging as open wounds, exposed bone, infection, dead tissue, and for those people. They probably have more advanced problems, and I have to go in and try to fix disease at multiple levels in order to restore blood flow and try to save their limb.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They might end up losing a toe or something like that, but the idea is to stop the damage there and improve the blood flow enough to where they can keep their leg. And the way I go about doing that are there's two particular kind of approaches that I take as a vascular surgeon. One is actually operating, where we do bypass operations, and there's a variety of bypass operations that we can do. And then the other thing I do is what we call minimally invasive or percutaneous procedures, where we do a puncture in the groin, and we take catheters and wires and balloons and stents and different devices, and we go in and directly work on the plaque that's blocking the arteries and try to open up the arteries.
Okay.
If you go back 25 years or 30 years ago to where I started in medicine, the vast majority of the procedures that were done was surgical.
Mm-hmm.
And then now if you fast forward three decades with all the developments in technology, I would say the vast majority of the procedures we do are percutaneous or puncture based.
Okay. That's a lot of information you just gave us. So I'm going to go back and ask a couple of questions about that. So basically the most common procedure that you do has to do with the arteries, lower extremity arteries.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that was a long answer. So the most common procedure I do today is percutaneous revascularization of the legs.
Okay. So before we move forward on that, before we talk about that, because you gave us two examples. One is actual surgery and bypass. So I'm hoping that we could paint a picture for our listeners to understand what that means, a bypass in the leg. And then the other one is kind of, what do you call it, non-invasive? Minimally invasive. Before we even go there. So can you give us an idea of who deals with these lower extremity complications? Is it more common in men than women? Is it common in younger people than older? Can you kind of, in this time, give us a profile of that patient who deals with these situations?
So my patients are typically older. If you go back, 3 decades ago when I first started, the average age of my patients was in their late 60s and maybe 70s. And now, fast forward, 20, 25, 30 years, the age has come a little bit younger because we're dealing with more aggressive disease at a younger age. And so it's not unusual now for patients to present sometimes in their late 50s and even early 60s. So from an age standpoint, late 50s, 60s, and early 70s is probably what I see the most of. There's no preponderance for men over women. It's about the same. There is some thought that men tend to get more peripheral arterial disease or peripheral vascular disease early on. But the studies now show that once women go through menopause, they typically catch up in the extent of disease.
Wow.
And that's only one factor that causes the disease. So all of the other factors, contribute to it. So we don't see a preponderance of men over women.
Okay.
At the point where I treat them. And then age is one factor. I think men and women get it pretty much equally. And then the other things that are major risk factors and characteristics of my patients are those with a lot of chronic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have patients who present without other major problems. And probably the number one presenting issue is diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a close second is hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
And then lipid disorders or high cholesterol is also the other thing. And then along with that is obesity.
Mm-hmm.
So those are really the four major risk factors that we see that lead to this disease. And so the patients who present to me, those who walk in my door, mm-hmm. have some, at least one of those problems, mm-hmm. if not a combination, and it's not unusual to see somebody with all of those problems.
So what happens when the patient, how does a patient even know that they have a blockage and that a procedure is required?
So, the blockages are building up silently in all of us throughout the course of our lifetimes. And this is not really a disease of 60 and 70 year olds. It starts when we're younger. I point to the Korean War vet study that looked at Korean War vets killed in action, and about 80% of them had the beginnings of atherosclerosis or peripheral arterial disease, but they were all, the average age of those young men was 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So we know this starts at an early age,
mm-hmm.
but what it is, it's growing slowly but isn't causing problems until it reaches a certain point many decades down the road. And once it reaches that point, then symptoms start to occur. And we call that when they become hemodynamic. Okay, hemodynamic meaning they affect the blood flow. You can have a blockage up to a certain extent and the blood flow still, does okay,
mm-hmm.
and still provides enough blood flow for our bodily functions. But
mm-hmm.
once you reach a certain critical mass, then that begins to affect our function. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that happens too with these blockages, as they get worse, blood clots form,
mm-hmm.
or the plaque ruptures. And these things typically don't become symptomatic till later on in life. So this, how do we know? I mean, you don't know for the first few decades because you're not having symptoms. And then when we suddenly fall over the precipice, so to speak, we fall over the edge or the cliff, and suddenly we begin to have problems.
So a patient comes to you and they say, "Doctor, my legs are hurting. I'm bruising. I can't walk. What are the symptoms? What are they telling you that then you go and you say, or have they been referred to you by the primary care physician? How does that work?"
Yeah, typically my patients are referred by the primary care physician because patients don't just come in the door to me. They're
mm-hmm.
typically going to go talk to their primary care doctor, or maybe they've gone into the emergency room and then they get referred to me. But yeah, one of the early presenting symptoms is pain. Pain is an early symptom, one of the of the disease, but not all pain, like not all leg pain, is due to circulation disorders. Leg pain can be due to arthritis, it can be due to nerve problems, and it can be to circulation disorders. And so then it's up to me and you know my other colleagues who deal with these problems to discern what kind of issue it is. Is mm-hmm. it a vascular problem? Is it a neurologic problem? Is it a musculoskeletal problem? There's very specific patterns of pain that are more likely vascular. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, when people are walking and they require more blood flow to their muscles to walk, then they might experience pain in their calves or fatigue or tiredness in their thighs. And that's what's called claudication. In more advanced cases, someone might have pain at rest. That's typically pain down in the feet. And that's because the blood vessels are smaller and they're kind of the endpoints. And so if you have blockages up high, not as much blood is reaching the feet. Mm-hmm. And so people will begin to experience pain at rest in their feet. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the early examples. Claudication, which is that pain when walking, mm-hmm. is an early symptom of somebody. Rest pain is a late symptom with someone with more advanced disease. Mm-hmm. And so that's how people might present. And then also, again, I talked about wounds, and that's a particularly ominous presentation because then at that point, patients are very often behind the eight ball, so to speak, where if we cannot fix them, they are at risk for losing their limb.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the later on you present, the more advanced the problem is and the harder it is to fix.
Okay. All right.
I think that it's particularly telling that somewhere between 5 and 10% of my patients, there's nothing I can do for them, and mm-hmm. they end up eventually end up with an amputation.
Do you want to talk about what happens when there's a recommendation made to the patient's family, and then the family does not necessarily want to follow through with the procedure?
Yeah. The field of vascular is a very complex field, and it's oftentimes, patients present with quite advanced problems. And as we alluded to earlier, all of my patients have multiple chronic conditions. We call these comorbidities, other medical problems going on. So these are not typically well patients. They've got lots of things going on. And, I think one of the hardest things to deal with within my profession for both me and for my patients and their families is that we talk about amputation. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think, you know, you may be talking to, I think I probably told you about something recently where someone presented and their problem was too advanced. Mm-hmm. There was just nothing that we could do for them. And so we had suggested that the patient undergo an amputation. But the family, of course, anytime you present someone with the option of amputation, that's just really way out there for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, from my standpoint, I see it on a regular basis, but for them, they may have never seen it before. And so to wrap their heads around that is tough. And it's not unusual from time to time that the family just can't handle that thought of it. Yeah. Yeah. That concept and the thought of it and just say, no, we don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. We don't suggest amputation just for the sake of amputation. If the patient can manage their leg and their wound and be okay with that, you know, we will allow that. But if we're suggesting amputation, it's likely because that means that the leg is accelerating towards death, and a dead leg is toxic to the body. And so I think I think what got your attention was how I told you recently in one case, the family refused to have the amputation done, and then they took their family member home. But then the family member presented emergently about a week and a half later to the emergency room because they had become toxic and what we call septic from the leg. And so these are, you know, they're tough. It's tough. And then that unfortunately then made it even tougher for us because now not only did we have to deal with a leg amputation, but we had to deal with a sick patient who had infection in their blood and their kidneys were failing. And then she also had a bad heart, which is not unusual in my patients. So, she was going into heart failure because of these problems. So
Right. Now
we're talking about trying to do a life-saving amputation in the face of other issues.
You know, it's a devastating decision to have to face as a family. I mean, the patient already, it's devastating for the patient, but then for family members who will then become the caretakers, it's even more devastating to see a loved one just falling apart like that. To have these kind of conversations for you might be, you know, it's part of your job. For the rest of us, it might be the only time that we deal with a loved one that's facing, you know, a possible amputation. So that's part of the reason why we work on the preventative end, not outside your practice, because once your patients are your patients, that's where they're kind of probably at the end of the road. But we're talking about in other cases, we want to help to raise awareness and educate so that people don't end up having to make a choice like this. But I wanted to focus on the procedures that you talked about. So you diagnose an individual who has a blockage, and then you said you either do a bypass or you do minimally invasive. So can you kind of paint a picture for us of what the bypass looks like and what part of the leg is that located typically?
So a bypass just means that we are using a tube to go around the blockage. We're basically putting in a new blood vessel. Uh-huh. And it can either be a person's own vein or an artificial vein or a donor vein, or it can be a piece of Dacron or plastic, which are artificial arteries. And they're not really so much artificial arteries because they're not really functioning as arteries other than they're just a tube. And the whole idea is they're meant to bypass a blockage. And everyone's kind of aware of heart bypass operations. And similarly, we do the same bypass operations on leg arteries. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole host of bypass operations. The legs are very long and there's lots of arteries in them. So we tailor the bypass to treat whatever blockage it is that we need to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's typically like the thigh area. Where is that located?
It can be the thigh area, or it can be the lower leg, or it can be the entire leg.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And what does recovery look like for something like that?
So bypass operations are pretty invasive procedures. They involve multiple incisions, and they're deep incisions because we're going down to the arteries, and then we're oftentimes creating tunnels with which to tunnel the new artificial artery. So they're pretty invasive. And so depending on the type of bypass, the recovery can be from 4 weeks to a couple of months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It does require a lot of time off of, for recovery. And these are pretty big operations for elderly people.
Right. Yeah. Again, I have to remember that you're dealing with an older population that has these procedures done.
Yeah. As the patients get older and sicker, the operations are harder on them and they're more prone to more complications.
Okay. So recovery happens for that individual who's had a bypass. And then does that mean then that once, you know, that they're functioning a lot better, their walking improves, what kind of improvements do they get as a result of this bypass?
Well, I mean, the bypasses are done for various reasons.
Right.
It could be done for pain. You know, claudication, mm-hmm. and or it could be done for gangrene of the foot. And so the recoveries are very different. If it's somebody who gets a fairly short, what we call femoral to popliteal bypass for claudication, mm-hmm. their recovery might be 4 weeks and they resume a very, very normal lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If it's someone with half of their foot eaten up by gangrene and we're doing a bypass from the groin all the way down to the ankle, well, the bypass is one thing, but then they might need weeks, months, or even years of wound care and treatment in order to try to get that wound to heal up now that we've improved the blood flow.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I always thought that once you had gangrene, there was no going back.
Well, so if there's gangrene, then you cut out the areas of gangrene and then get them to try to heal up. So
trying
to, if they've got gangrene of a toe, then hopefully all they lose is their toe.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Gangrene of the toe with blockages is just the tip of the iceberg. And they're never going to heal that, and it probably wouldn't heal higher up. Whereas if you restore the blood flow, then you can arrest the damage at a certain level, okay, or try to.
Right. And I know that I've avoided looking at photos of different cases because I just can't handle that. The gangrene on is just incredible. Okay. What about the minimally invasive? Those are a lot more common. Does that involve stenting?
Yeah. So we've transitioned over the last few decades to a more minimally invasive approach. And it's because we've been able to, with the developments in technology, we've been able to treat more and more advanced disease with these newer devices. Mm-hmm. So especially complete blockages and also blockages below the knee, which were things that in the past were not amenable to this kind of treatment and even weren't well treated with surgery. And now we have these new tools available to mm-hmm. us. So the interesting thing is, and I was discussing this with my colleague the other day, is that we're treating sicker patients and patients with more advanced disease today than we treated 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're more successful today than we were 30 years ago. So we're treating more advanced disease and we're more successful with it. And so we, you know, that's what the modern technologies have afforded us. And then also I always try to make sure I acknowledge that, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, these people who developed all these technologies 30, 40, 50 years ago, the surgeries, and then the ones who've developed these technologies as we've gone along have provided us with the opportunity to treat patients who are sicker and more advanced. There's a lot of patients that I treat today on a regular basis who 30 years ago, their primary treatment would have been amputation. Not an attempt to save the leg, but just, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, it's already too advanced. You need an amputation. Mm. So, I think that we're very fortunate that, we continue to develop and get better at treating this disease.
So stenting looks like what?
These procedures, the beauty of them is that they're done what's called twilight anesthesia, or what our technical term for it is conscious sedation or moderate sedation. And then that means that we're giving them certain medications in their IV to make them comfortable, sleepy, and even forgetful of the procedure. But they don't have to have that deep general anesthetic where the breathing tube is put in and they're put on the ventilator with the artificial life support of having to breathe for them. Mm-hmm. That's typically reserved for the major operations. And that's also one of the reasons major operations carry more risk, is because you have to put somebody to sleep. There's risk to that. Whereas when you're doing something with a minimally invasive technique and conscious sedation, you've not eliminated but markedly reduced the anesthetic risk.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Being that stenting is the most common procedure that you do a month, how long does something like that take to do a procedure?
It varies. It varies in length. There is no one blockage or one problem we're treating. Peripheral arterial disease is complex. It's multi-level. And, I could be treating somebody with just a blockage in their thigh, mm-hmm. or I could be treating somebody with a blockage in their pelvis, in their groin, in their thigh, and two blockages in their lower leg below the knee. Mm-hmm. And those each carry different treatments and mm-hmm. lengths of treatment. So, you know, one procedure might take half an hour and another one might take 3 hours.
Okay. So you have cancellations. Why?
Yeah. You know, we do have a lot of cancellations and it's kind of an unfortunate thing. And it's multifactorial. Scheduling procedures is not a minor thing too. You have to schedule the surgeon, the operating room, the anesthesiologist. So there's a whole lot of moving parts that are there. And then you have to get the patient in, you know. So there's a lot of moving parts that need to be coordinated in order to get a procedure done. And so things can go wrong at different levels. Unfortunately, there's a high level of noncompliance that exists. But why does that happen? It can be as simple as sometimes patients can't get a ride, you know, we're talking about an elderly population who themselves may not drive. Mm-hmm. They oftentimes rely on their family, to get them in, and that may or may not, that can fall through there. It's also, there's preoperative instructions, and it's not uncommon for a patient to have, eaten breakfast or, or had, you know, some coffee with dairy in it when they were instructed not to, but they didn't understand it. So that can happen.
That's the most common thing I hear you say is the person ate something in the morning, and so the procedure had to be canceled. That's the one thing I hear you say. Not so much they couldn't get a ride. I hear you say two things. The person ate, and therefore the procedure has to be canceled. And the patient decided they just are not in the mood to have the procedure, so they're going to put it off. And most of yours are not necessarily elective procedures for the sake of having a procedure. They're usually very important to have done.
Right, right. Yeah. So the probably is the number one reason is someone ate before the procedure. And the reason we ask people not to eat before the procedure for 8 hours is because we need them to have an empty stomach. When people get anesthesia, whether it's a general anesthetic or the twilight anesthesia that I talked about, their gag reflex is inhibited, and so fluid can wash back up or reflux from their stomach. And one of the risks there is that if it goes into the lungs, they can get what's called an aspiration pneumonia. And so there's, you know, there it's very easy to prevent that from happening if they don't eat.
Well, that's news to me. I hope everyone's listening out there, because that's the first time I ever have heard of that. But then I don't go and have, you know, procedures. So when the doctor or the surgeon schedules the patient and says, hey, make sure you don't have anything to eat, that's like a big one for us to make a note of for our loved ones if we're caretaking. Okay, mom, you're not supposed to have any breakfast on the day of because of these complications. And then usually the person, sometimes I've heard you say the person tries to lie.
Yeah.
That they didn't have like really coffee or something.
And that's because they don't understand the negative consequences of a complication related to eating. So, yeah, I mean, it's again, something as simple as not eating can prevent that particular complication. And if they've eaten, then it's not prudent to proceed unless it's just a dire emergency. Mm-hmm. And so that is probably one of the more common reasons that the procedures get canceled.
Okay.
There are many, many reasons that a procedure might get canceled. But that
the main reason I wanted to emphasize this is because I think like an educator. I think like a teacher. I think, well, if we get this information out and we tell people on a regular basis, hey, by the way, if you have an appointment scheduled for this kind of procedure and you're asked not to eat anything, try really, really hard not to. Because not only will that cause you to not have the procedure done that day, but now everyone who the team that has been lined up and set up for your procedure, now that spot was taken and it cannot be filled. And sometimes you have medication that is cracked open and ready. I don't know the details, but you tell me certain things like that. And so that's wasted time and wasted money for everyone. And then to schedule that patient to come in at another time in the future with the tight schedule that you have is pretty tricky, especially if that individual is in great need of having the procedure done in the first place. Probably don't want to ruin it because you had breakfast that morning.
Yeah, those are tough. Those are tough things. And so, yeah, I mean, first off, again, putting together surgery is not cheap. We're mm-hmm. talking about expensive operating rooms, the time of the anesthesiologist and the surgeon, the operating room staff. And so just to schedule a surgery is probably costs thousands of dollars. Okay. Mm-hmm. In our society. And so if someone doesn't show up for their surgery or their surgery gets canceled at the last minute, that spot is not going to be filled. Mm-hmm. And so that's a wasted slot that did cost money, and somebody else who could have used it doesn't get to use it. So that's number one. Then, you talked about the schedule. I'm typically booked weeks in advance, as are most busy surgeons. And so if this patient who got canceled needed this surgery relatively urgent, and most of my work is not elective surgery. Most of my work is something that needs to be done in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. Well, then if I'm booked for weeks, then I'll have to bump somebody else. And that happens regularly where I have to look down the road and go, okay, who can be bumped so that we can put this patient back on the schedule? So it might take weeks to get that patient back on the schedule, especially if it wasn't something that was urgent.
Yeah. See, I feel like today we had a lot of valuable information, and I hope that our listeners found it valuable as well, because this kind of seeing that side of Dr. Riss, the surgeon hat, and the procedures that he does regularly throughout the month is very important to know. The stenting, the diagnosing symptoms that people have, improvements that they see after a procedure, and also the importance of just being compliant so that things are smoother in the office. And then, because, you know, time is money and money is time. And when people don't respect that because either they decided to have breakfast or decided that they weren't in the mood for a procedure, well, then that just messes everything up. And so, okay. Anything else to add before we wrap up about that?
You know, I mean, I think that it was good to share what I do on a regular basis. But what I really want to point out is there's, what I treat is very advanced, severe disease and very sick patients. It's not uncommon for the hospital to acknowledge that mine are the sickest patients in the hospital. Mm-hmm. What we call they have the highest acuity. And that means that they have not only is there a particular illness that I'm treating bad, but they have multiple other problems. Mm-hmm. And what that brings to mind to me is that I don't want people to have these problems. And I joke about it, but there is some truth to the fact that I'm trying to put myself out of business. Mm-hmm. And why do I bring this up is that I don't want anybody out there to get what I treat. And the best way to do that is to prevent it from happening. Mm-hmm. What I treat is actually a temporizing measure. I'm just bypassing a blockage or opening up a blockage, but the disease process that caused it to get there isn't going away just because I open up an artery or even, you know, saving a leg. That patient, my patients are come back to me over and over again, even after I fix something. And so the idea here is that what I'm getting at is that the best way not to be my patient, and you don't want to be my patient, the best way not to be my patient is to prevent the disease. Mm-hmm. And that's through aggressive lifestyle changes.
Yep. Well, Dr. Riss, this was very valuable. Let us know what you think about today's topic. Go to the show notes. If you're watching the video, leave us a comment. What other things would you like to hear Dr. Riss like really go into detail about, especially things that he does to support his patients? So, let us know what you thought about it. And Dr. Riss, thank you again for sharing all your knowledge.
Thank you very much. You know what I think would be interesting is if you guys out there would send us questions, because someday I'd like to do a Q&A.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. All right. Thanks again for listening.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast with your host, Maya Acosta. If you've enjoyed this content, please share with one friend who can benefit. You can also leave us a 5-star review at ratethispodcast.com/HLS. This helps us to spread our message. As always, thank you for being a listener.